Hey, Max Rivers here with day number 13. Today we're going to start chapter 5. We're going to be talking about empathy, listening your relationship back to love. So empathy is kind of the NVC superpower. We've mentioned it before in passing, and today we're going to go into it in some more depth. Empathy is the skill of how to listen for feelings and needs. So this is the way that you can be helpful to others, helping them identify what it is that they're needing. And there's also self-empathy, where you can listen to yourself and help yourself identify what it is you're feeling and needing. So let's go to chapter 5. One of the most important skills in the teamwork method is offering a perfect mirror for your partner so they can see past their own stories and judgments and find their beautiful, universal human needs. We do this by carefully putting our attention where it will offer the most healing on feelings and needs. We call this practice empathy when we do it for others and self-empathy when we do it for ourselves. What kind of listening is wanted? Empathic listening is the skill that will likely have the greatest effect on avoiding those same old arguments. There are at least 7 ways to listen. Most people don't know about this stuff. Sympathy, fixing, one-upping, educating, cajoling, interrogating, comparing, and each one has its value in its appropriate time and place. Whether we know it or not, every speaker is hoping to be listened to in the one way that will meet their needs in the moment. That's why, if you choose to listen attentively, but in a way that is different from what they need, they are likely to complain to you, "You're not listening to me." We see this a lot. The other person says, "I was listening." They were listening using the wrong kind of listening, though. Not really the wrong kind. They were listening to the kind that the person was not hoping would be the way they'd be listened to. When our needs are satisfied, or at least when we know what is needed and is wanting satisfaction, that proximity to satisfaction puts us in a resourced state. So even if your needs aren't getting met in the moment, once you know what it is that you're needing, that puts you in a resourced state. You now have the information you need in order to proceed, because needs motivate everything that we do and everything that we say. There are 2 levels of being unresourced, however. One level is knowing you have an unsatisfied need, but you don't know what it is. So you're not resourced because you don't know what the need is, but you are looking in the right place. You know that the problem is that you have an unsatisfied need, and now you need to figure out what it is. The other level of being unresourced is reacting to your dissatisfaction by blaming others, because not only don't you know what it is that you need, you don't even know that a need of yours is the issue. And this unresourced state is not knowing what you don't know. You don't know that you have an unsatisfied need, and that causes you to flail around, and often our attention goes outward, especially if we're in a relationship, and goes towards attacking our partner. This can be very frustrating to the listener. They may not realize that, once again, needs are what is really going on here. Instead, they are likely to take the judgment at face value of your complaining that they're not listening, get defensive, and respond with the perfectly true statement, "I was listening." Now you're off to the races with another same old argument, this time about the form of listening instead of the content, or more importantly, the needs that are present. So if you're fighting about whether or not the other person is listening, you're 2 levels away from getting your needs met. It's the responsibility, ideally, of the person who has the need to make the request so the other person can choose, make an informed choice about whether or not they would like to give you empathy or listen to you in the way that you want to be listened to. It can be incredibly difficult to know what kind of listening a speaker wants, because most people don't know about the different levels of listening. They may not even know what needs they're trying to get met by being listened to, until that need is obviously not being met by their partner's, quote, inattention, unquote. In fact, even if you ask, people will often give you the wrong answer. The question, what do you think about this new dress, may be a request for information about the fit or style. More likely, it is a request for appreciation and or connection, which would be an empathy request as opposed to a request for information. So if you tell them what you think, which is what they literally asked for, what do you think about this dress, you can find yourself inexplicably in the doghouse. So it's very important to notice form. We talk about this a lot. If the form that you ask the other person to listen to you is, what do you think about this, and they tell you what they think about it, and you're not actually interested in what it is they're thinking, you want to know, you want help understanding what you're feeling, don't ask for what they're thinking. Ask them if they're willing to give you empathy. The good news is, using the teamwork method, you're not stuck with just one kind of listening, and we'll be teaching you the kind of listening that is most often wanted in relationship, empathy, empathic listening. About 80% of the time, people who want to talk about something that they have an emotional charge on want to be listened to with empathy. So if you're being asked to listen to someone and it's clear they have an emotional charge, our recommendation is try empathy instead of any of the other ways that you might think about listening. They are in an unresourced state, and they need help understanding their feelings so they can get clear about what it is they're needing. For people who are used to dealing with facts and solving problems, i.e. men, and also a lot of women, this can seem like a waste of time. So you just want me to listen to you, but not fix the problem or even offer suggestions? The other person may say, that's right, but that's not actually what empathy is. It's true that empathy is not fixing or suggesting solutions. That comes later. These are strategies, and couples can get themselves stuck by jumping to strategy before they even know what the needs are that they're trying to satisfy, because that's what strategies do. They exist to satisfy needs. If you don't know what the needs are, starting to suggest strategies is premature. This tactic can be especially enticing when the situation seems urgent, but it doesn't speed things up to pick a strategy before you know the need. What would your choice be based on? Most likely your habitual pattern or some culturally suggested strategy. So before you go off offering suggestions, be sure to find out what the need is, because that's what empathy is, identifying feelings and needs. So here's one of the reasons that empathy works better than problem solving when the problem is an unsatisfied need and not a lack of information. An important difference between fixing and empathy is your starting proposition. Fixing assumes there's a problem that needs fixing. And when this is what people are wanting, that's fine. So if I'm sitting by the side of the road with my hood up and I have no idea what's going on inside of my engine, if you stop along the side of the road, I'm likely to be very interested in your ideas about how to fix this situation. Empathy might help if I'm really going to be stuck, but fixing would really be useful because I'm really in need of information right then. But that's not the same as when people are asking for your empathic attention. You're trying to fix them is just going to feel condescending, because needs aren't about the situation. They are about the person. Needs are the truth about the person. When you're working on fixing a problem and they're trying to discover the beautiful life-affirming need that holds deep satisfaction for them, they are very likely to feel unseen and misunderstood. No matter how good your strategy is, even if ultimately it ends up being the one that they select, The first step in dealing with a person in an unresourced state is to help them identify the need. So this is another important point sort of in the text here, which is empathy is not about telling them what their need is or even asking them what their need is. It's listening to what they say and responding in such a way that they start to identify what it is that they're feeling and needing. Now, we do make feeling guesses, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But even a feeling guess is just offering them a suggestion, which they're then going to check inside themselves and see if, in fact, that is what they feel. And once they know what they feel and their attention is in their body, that may take them down to what it is that they're needing. There are also questions you can ask to help them identify what it is that they're needing. Some people, in some situations, it can be helpful. Like I, as a mediator, when I'm teaching people about needs, I will sometimes make need guesses. But it's much more empowering for you to listen to a person in such a way that they figure out what's going on with them. And empowerment is a good thing. Excited curiosity. So the starting place for empathy is what we call excited positive curiosity. As a mediator, before I cross the threshold into a room with two disgruntled disputants, I take a deep breath, put a smile on my face, and think to myself, I wonder what they're needing. And I can't wait to help them find their mutual satisfaction. Then, the whole time I'm listening with empathy, about 90% of my job as a mediator, all I'm doing is listening for universal human needs. Expressed usually as feeling names, thought feelings, strategies, and judgments, and on very rare occasions, directly as needs. So in this culture, you're not going to be able to expect a person to be jumping in talking about their needs unless they're trained in NVC. They're more likely to be telling you feelings, thoughts, story, judgment, and our job as empathic listeners is to listen through all of those things directly to the need. It used to take me 2 hours listening to all that stuff until I realized what I'm really interested in is what's underneath all of that. And now it only takes me 5 minutes at the beginning of a session to begin working on what it is that people are needing. What I say to people in the first session is, my model tells me that what is actually going on here is that each of you have some essential needs that are not getting satisfied. Since needs can only be satisfied in the present, I'm really only interested in this present moment. If there is a story from the past which still has a charge on it, I want to know about that. Here's why. Because the past charge tells me that at the moment the story begins, a need of yours went unsatisfied. And the fact that the charge is still with you tells me that every moment from that moment to this, that need has continued to go unsatisfied. I'm not that interested in the story about why it went unsatisfied in the past, because this present moment is the only time that we can get those needs met. So I'll be listening to your story just long enough to identify the need so that we can get busy getting that need met. In other words, if you stopped eating 3 days ago, we could spend this session discussing why you stopped eating. Or I could give you a sandwich now and then teach you how to make sandwiches into the future. That second approach is the one that we'll be doing. So that's my little spiel that I do at the beginning of working with couples, but it's basically a description of what empathy is. So people are likely to be telling you stories that happened in the past. Sometimes they're stories about their anxiety about the future. Very few stories are about what's actually going on in the present, which is where needs actually exist. And so as a listener who's using empathy, what you want to be doing is reconjugating all the verbs from the past or the future into the present and be listening not to the story and not to the judgments, but listening for the feelings and the needs. We call empathy a way of listening, but that isn't completely accurate. This suggests that empathy is about the words being spoken, but what we're really listening for are the needs underneath the feelings. So needs and feelings are unconscious phenomenon, and I like to use metaphors when I'm talking to the unconscious. And so this is a picture of my sense of what empathy is about. So, you know, in the Bible, there's this story about your cup runneth over. So there's your cup that's running over. And they don't really describe what it is that's inside of your cup. From an NVC perspective, I would say that it's empathy. So when your cup overrunneth with empathy, in other words, when you are connected with your feeling and your needs, the life of them, your cup overflows. You have more empathy than you need, and it will then pour out onto the floor. Rather than pouring it on the floor, ideally what you would want to do is to pour it into the cup of the person that you're in relationship with. And a healthy relationship looks like this picture, where you have two cups that are pouring into each other. It's kind of like an Escher drawing, because it's not possible in physics. But this is what a healthy relationship looks like. Each of you are full to overflowing, and you're continuing to fill each other up. An unresourced person's cup looks like this. So their cup is empty, or at least not full to overflowing. It's surprising how just the little tiniest little incident can use up the overflow and have at least some of the lip showing, or even empty your cup all the way down. And that's what I'd like to talk about next, is the physics of empathy. Different levels of perception have different rules of behavior. Einstein found that Newton's laws don't work at the subatomic level, and likewise, you shouldn't expect to use the same emotional physics with your boss, your partner, and your kids. In the cup metaphor, although it looks like a fluid in the cup, in the realm of feelings and empathy, this fluid doesn't behave like coffee or water. The level of empathy in your cup fluctuates instantaneously with the satisfaction or dissatisfaction of your present needs. So you may wake up feeling great and notice that your cup runneth over. Then you glance at the clock and see that you're already 20 minutes behind schedule, and your cup may suddenly look like the empty cup. This is what frustration or disappointment looks like in your cup. Your cup no longer runneth over. It's not empty, necessarily, but you don't have any extra empathy to give others. This is an important thing to understand. NVC says, if you don't have empathy for yourself, if you don't have enough empathy, you don't have empathy to give others. As we'll see in a moment, this can be remedied quickly, just as quickly as it was unfilled. One way to use the cup metaphor is to notice when you and or your partner's cup is not full and change your behavior accordingly. So if your cup or your partner's cup is not filled to overflowing, you're not going to be able to be giving and receiving as freely because you don't have that extra energy. And ideally, you should really only give the extra energy and not be giving the life force energy that you're needing in order to be fully satisfied yourself. In the real world, parents and counselors and mediators and a lot of others do need to learn how to park their needs for a time and give empathy even when their own cup is not full. Doing this occasionally or in limited circumstances can be handled, but there is a tipping point where giving what you don't have will begin to deplete your reserve of joy and negatively impact your quality of life. So this is a suggestion for parents and others that the situations may require that you give even when your cup is not full, but you should notice that that's what you're doing and not do that as a matter of course. NVC has some great ideas about how to do parenting, and I recommend those of you that are parents to go onto YouTube and search for parenting and NVC, and you'll see some amazing young people who are incredibly in touch with their feelings and needs, and maybe even more importantly, know that they need to negotiate to get their needs met with their parents' needs. I think it's incredibly important that parents very early on begin to show their children that the parents have needs also, and that children need to take other people's needs into account. This kind of helicopter parenting that we're doing, I've mentioned this before, these days, I think gives a very bad message to young people that their needs are the only ones that count. If you want your children to grow up to have healthy relationships, you want to begin negotiating with them as soon as possible. Obviously, when they're infants, their needs count. But really, pretty quickly, age 1 and 2, they start to be able to notice that other people exist, and you can begin to, in a very gentle way, let them know the state of your cup so that they come to understand. First of all, you'll be modeling for them states of cups so that they can internalize that for themselves. And second of all, this will help them be able to start to identify when other people's cups are in different states and start to learn how to help other people meet their needs and when not to expect other people to be meeting their needs. Self-empathy. When your cup is low, it's time for self-empathy. If empathy is having someone listen to you to help you identify what you are feeling and needing, then why can't you be one of the people who helps you? In fact, since you're always around and available when you have an unmet need, you're the perfect one to use in a pinch. So clearly, if your state of empathy is so low that you don't have the attention even for yourself, then you may need to be resting or asking for help from other people. But a lot of the time, people sit in a state of upset and continue to upset themselves and do what we call fire tending, which instead, it would be a good idea to do empathy on yourself. So if I am in an unresourced state, I'll have this little guy that sits on my shoulder say to me, "All right, Max, so what is it that you're needing?" And I'll often answer, "I don't know, I need the other person to be less selfish." And he'll go, nope, that's not a need. What is it that you're needing? I think what I want to do is I do want to go to fire tending, which was a part of the feeling chapter that I skipped, and I'm realizing now it's becoming useful. So this is a concept that I came up with about our relationships to our feelings that I think will impact us. Several years ago, I figured out how I used to keep myself upset longer than necessary, which I've come to call fire tending. I learned about it as a result of one of those same old arguments with Elise early on in our relationship. I don't remember what the fight was about. Whenever I was upset, Elise, bless her heart, would listen to my ranting for anything that might be her responsibility, and as soon as it was clear it had nothing to do with her, she would just walk away, leaving me to have the argument by myself. That is what was happening this particular time, and so I walked around the house muttering my complaints and getting angrier and angrier. At some point, it became so ludicrous that even I noticed that I was having an argument all by myself. But what was even more fascinating to me was the fact that the argument was progressing along just fine without the need for anyone else. I decided to watch and learn how I was doing that. I ran into Elise a few hours later and told her I was no longer angry at her, but I was doing a thought experiment to learn about anger. Since she knows me so well, she accepted this, and so I was free to do this experiment without compromising her sense of safety. As the day wore on, I got angrier and angrier, and by bedtime I didn't want to sleep with her, so I went to sleep in the guest room. I woke up the next morning surprised by where I was, until I remembered what had been going on. Although I woke up calm, just like when I was camping as a kid, I found that if I stirred the ashes of my anger from last night's fiery feelings, I could stir up a few hot coals, and with a little blowing, I could start the fire again. I was able to do this same thing with my anger. In just a few minutes, I managed to get the hot judgment thoughts going again. This is why I call this fire tending. I discovered that I'm totally capable of pissing myself off. I also know how to hurt my own feelings, make myself sad, and create upset. So, you know, I get couples who come to me and say, you know, if we have a fight and he gets upset, it'll be like 7 or 8 days before he calms down. 7 or 8 days, really? Some people it's 3 or 4 days. Some people it's like 8 or 9 hours. You know what? That's fire tending. We know how to hurt our own feelings. We know how to piss ourselves off. There's no benefit to it. What's going on there is you have an unsatisfied need, you're in a very unresourced state, and you're using this other guy who sits on this other shoulder, what I call the isolator, what Marshall used to call the jackal, to keep telling me these terrible judgmental things to keep upset feelings going. That's not the way you want to deal with your unresourced state. What you want to be doing is listening in such a way that you can hear not the thought feelings, which is what fire tending is about, but the body sensations and the needs that they represent. So that's our half hour for today. What I want to suggest that you do is notice your relationship to listening to yourself and listening to others. Notice if you do fire tending, if you happen to get angry. And if you're in relationship with someone and it seems like they're in an unresourced state, see if you can identify what it is that they're feeling. And before you even respond, let yourself feel what it is that they're likely to be feeling. Just be present for them. See if that makes a difference. Instead of jumping into trying to fix them, figure out what the problem is, stop and solve that problem. Maybe they don't have a problem. Maybe they have an unrealized potential. So we'll be getting into the skills of empathy next week, and then we'll start section 2 of the book, which talks about once the war has ended and you're having teamwork kind of relationship, how you can create that mature relationship and keep building on the love and connection using these same skills that are so great at stopping all the arguments. I'm also going to be bringing in some guests to my talk in the evening, and my book is up on Amazon on Prime, if you're on Amazon Prime. So have a great, peaceful, empathic weekend. This is Max, signing off. This is day 14 of my reading from my book, Loving Conflict. Our shadows are fighting, well, our needs are really wanting us to love. You can put your orders in now on Amazon.com. Look up either my name, Max Rivers, or Loving Conflict. And these videos are going to become an audio, so I'll be extracting the audio from this, and you'll be able to listen to this in your car as you're riding along, learning how to get along with your partner. And they'll also be these videos will probably be available on YouTube and maybe some other places as well. So that's all that excitement. Today we're going to be continuing talking about empathy, which is really kind of the super skill set for mediation and for the teamwork method. So yesterday we defined that empathy is listening for the feelings and needs, not the story or the judgment of the other person. And so today we're going to go a little bit more into detail about actually how to do empathy and how not to do it. So here we go. Reading from my book, Chapter 5, Empathy, Listening Your Relationship Back to Love. The feeling-pain dichotomy. The driving force for a lot of people who are in upset is pain. At the top of our energetic system is a driving force towards increased pleasure. If you talk about pleasure to people who are at the bottom of the scale, they look at you like they don't know what you're talking about. Pleasure is always available to everybody, and yet at the lower end of the scale, it seems like less and less of a possibility. So one of the things that I like to do sometimes, if a couple comes in and they're just like really stuck in their upset, and they say to me, you know, can you help us with this upset? My answer is, no, I don't do upset. That's way too small a problem to solve with way too big a tool. What I'm interested in actually doing is teaching you how to have the marriage that you always wanted, the happy marriage. And they kind of go, geez, we totally forgot about that. We've been so busy fighting. When people are in upset, they actually lose access to the idea that pleasure is what this is really actually supposed to be all about. My wife and I use that as the guiding light in our relationship. Would this be pleasurable is the first and last question that we ask whenever we're doing any kind of negotiation. Would that be pleasurable? If not, we find some other strategy to meet those needs. So avoid contradicting someone's experience, talking about empathy again. People often make the mistake of contradicting the other person's experience in an attempt to be helpful. If I were to say to my mother, for instance, I'm really upset, nothing is going right for me right now, her response would be, no, it isn't, your life is terrific. Most people observing that interaction would understand that there is something about her response that doesn't work. But the self-responsibility scale, the scale that I was just talking about, explains why. It's too big a jump from where I am to what she's offering. The other mistake people can make is repeating back exactly what they said. This obviously isn't too big a jump, but it can be seen to us as too small a change. So what we're talking about here is when somebody's in a particular state of self-responsibility. So if they're down at the bottom where they're just totally in upset, or if they're not quite up at the top, which is self-responsibility and I create my own happiness, wherever they are along that scale, when you're doing empathy, what you want to do is to respond to them a tiny bit higher than where they are. If you respond too much higher, like the example in here about my mom, they'll just feel judged or not understood. If it's too small a jump, like if you agree with them in their upset, that's not a healing proposition. It, in fact, could lock them in to the level of upset that they're at. So sympathy, which is that, it's sympathetically vibrating with where they are, may be the right tool if the wound is really fresh. So if a person's parents just died and you're at the funeral, I might even have this in here, you don't want to be telling them everything's going to be fine. They want sympathy at that point. They basically want to feel that they're not crazy in the way that they feel. And so sympathetically vibrating with them, yeah, I understand. This is a terrible time. But short of when they're in crisis, when they're in healing mode, you don't want to respond to them at exactly the level that they're at because it doesn't offer any healing potential. You want to be just high enough above where they are in terms of self-responsibility, in terms of healing, to offer them a mirror back which offers them a little bit more self-responsibility, understanding, attention on the needs. When reflecting with an empathy guess, keep your language just a half tick above their statement. If done correctly, it will sound to them as though you just repeated exactly what they said. This kind of reframe that's a half step more self-responsible will likely sound like a good reflection to them. If they agree with your reframe, they have actually moved one half step up the self-responsibility scale. So if a person comes in and says, you know, I'm just totally a victim to my husband's rage, what I might say back is, so I'm hearing that you feel like a victim to your husband's rage. And they would say, yeah, I do. They've actually moved up a half step from I am a victim to I'm feeling like a victim, which is different because it's now there's a part of them which is feeling that as opposed to all they are is a victim. The verb to be is all the way down at the bottom of the scale. That's what I am, and there's no room for change. The goal of using self-responsibility scale is to keep reflecting back one half step above where the other person is. Not so far that it sounds like you're changing their reality, but far enough that you're not joining them in their lower level. Another way of saying this is to say back what they said, but make it just a tiny bit truer. And remember, truth here is another name for universal human needs. So a little closer to what they're actually needing, as opposed to the upset that's the result of what they're thinking about, or believing, or judging. How empathy heals. What the scale suggests is that when you reflect what the other person shares a half step up the scale, if they join you there, then they have healed themselves by becoming less limited in their worldview. This takes them closer to connecting to the life-affirming energy of the need, which lives at the top of this scale. As we continue to reflect another half step up, we're continually adding a little bit more self-responsibility, and we're offering them more choice and freedom in their life. So at the bottom of the scale, people are talking in changeless language. I am a victim. Marshall said that the thing that causes us upset is talking about the ever-changing moment in changeless language. So the moment is always moving from one truth to another. And if people are talking in unchanging language, then they're basically stuck. And our job as empathizers is to just add a little bit more truth, little by little, as we're responding to them, to create more changeful freedom for them, so that eventually they can get back in touch with the whole truth of their need. This is one of the reasons we don't respond to story when we're empathizing. Because if you respond to the details of the story, you are joining the other at their level of self-responsibility. If you do that, then there is no one in the room in a more resourced state. So, for instance, children. Parents learn pretty quickly that if your child gets upset, joining them in the upset doesn't help. It may be upsetting that your kid is upset in the supermarket or right before you're going to be taking them off to school and you're late, but parents learn pretty quickly that if your child is in an unresourced state, if they're an upset child, then joining them with your upset child isn't the way to parent them. What they need is a calm adult who can create safety and wisdom in the present time. And so you want to do the same thing when you're listening to yourself or to other adults. You want to show up as a resourced person, as somebody who is connected to the safe present time environment and is excitedly curious about what the truth here is, what the need here is, as opposed to joining them in the upset and the story. So to be a healing presence to others, we respond half a level up from where anyone who is looking for empathy is. By making that tiny change in our reflections, we're giving them the opportunity to choose a more self-responsible freedom and choice. They may choose not to accept it, but if we are aware that they are in an unresourced state, we want to offer them the possibility. So they have free will. Doing empathy doesn't guarantee that the person is going to rise all the way up to identifying their needs, especially if they don't know this process. They may not even know about needs. But as a mediator, I can tell you that if you bring in this kind of a small step kind of adding self-responsibility and keep focusing on the beauty of their needs and the freedom of their choice, people are often really attracted to that. And if they're able to push out of their patterns, they'll be drawn and attracted to that. You can take them up the scale till they connect with the understanding that they have a need, which immediately puts them in a resource state, and then you're doing empathy with them to help them identify what the need is and maybe even help them identify what strategy would really work for them. And if you're in relationship with them, negotiate with them with your needs so you can co-create a strategy that meets both parties' needs. And so that's that two-cup situation. So in the pictures of cups, you'll notice that there's one set of cups where one cup is empty and the other person is pouring their empathy down on the ground. Their cup runneth over. And that's a state that you might be in. Your partner's in an unresourced state and you're in a very resourced state. And in the next picture, you see that the person whose cup is running over pours some of their empathy into the other person's cup. And with our quality attention, it may help them to fill their cup up. And then in the third picture, you see what a two-cup resourced relationship looks like. It's kind of an Escher drawing where you have one person pouring into the other person's cup and that person pouring back into that person's cup. And when your relationship is like that, 24/7, 365, where you're just pouring love and connection and empathy into each other's full cup and they're pouring it into you, very, very delicious. Very delicious. So that's the ultimate goal in my method of using empathy as a way of communicating with your partner, of continually being excitedly curious about what they're needing, about pouring your loving attention into their life and receiving that same back at the same time. Two resourced people loving each other. Yippee. Yippee. If at some point they reject the reframe, for instance, if they say, I feel angry, which is kind of one step up from I am angry, and you say back, so I'm wondering if you're feeling sad, which often is, especially with men, is a more true feeling than the culturally acceptable feeling of being angry, which men are one feeling men are allowed, and they say, no, I'm just angry, then you have overstepped their willingness to move up. Then this person is telling you, this is my reality, this is where we have to work from. And since this is a non-judgmental process, we accept, we offered them the choice of moving up, and they made a clear, although unconscious, decision to stay at the level where they are right now. This is where they're ready to be. And so the non-judgmental empathy at this point is to be a safe present time environment for where they are and maybe perch just a tiny bit up above them to keep giving them the opportunity to see a little more light and a little more truth and flexibility. There's healing available at every level. Once they decide to stay where they are, I'm going to continue to listen to them without judgment, because that's what empathy is at its most basic, listening without judgment. What I am going to do if they perch is find out what need of theirs is getting met by this level of self-responsibility. So it's interesting that even at a lower level of self-responsibility, people are choosing the feelings and action strategies that they're doing there because it's meeting some need of theirs. You know, it may meet their need for ease, or it may meet their need for mourning. And so accepting the truth of their situation is what we do in the perching version of empathy. They've stopped moving up. What I'm going to do if they perch is find out what need of theirs is getting met by this level of self-responsibility by making a needs guess. By going down into the need and getting out of the story that's holding them at some lower level of self-responsibility, they will have an opportunity to do the healing and get the satisfaction which is available at their level of self-responsibility, at their current level. There are needs that get met at the lower levels of self-responsibility, like comfort and security. By identifying the needs that are getting met and celebrating these satisfactions, and also maybe helping them mourn and celebrating the mourning that needs to be done at that level, we are bringing pleasure even to the lower levels of the scale. Now they are perching at this level not to avoid pain, but to enjoy the satisfaction that this level delivers to them, along with the connection with me and the celebration and joy we are having together. This will meet the connection needs that they may have been avoiding previously, including feeling seen and heard and understood and appreciated. So I consider these the kind of easiest set of needs to meet, helping the person feel seen and heard and understood and appreciated. A lot of couples come to me with like financial problems, and I can't solve their financial problems that's caused by our screwed up economy. But I can still meet needs of theirs even without solving their problem. I can meet these needs, these interpersonal needs. And what that does is it frees up a lot of their attention. And when they do it with each other, it creates a sense of teamwork. And then they, once they're on the same team, they can work together to come up with strategies that will meet the bigger issues. So as an empathy listener, our focus is not on solving their problem. It's on helping them get their needs met. In my experience, this creates a beneficial cycle, at least with me, that the person returns to quickly when we interact. When the person acclimates to this new non-judgmental environment, they are more likely to be willing to take risks and rise up the scale on their own. So one of the things that these kinds of needs, these interpersonal needs, can help with the overwhelm that people often feel when they're in an unresourced state and they've, quote, tried everything, and everything just seems to add to the upset and the overwhelm. And so just by being a non-judgmental, empathetic listener, I can help them with their overwhelm. And that may free up more resources for them to be willing to start to move back up the self-responsibility scale towards the actual truth of the real need, which is going on underneath, which is communicating there to them through this dissatisfaction. This next section is called Avoiding the Mourning. That's M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G, mourning, not the time of day. What locks people into the lower levels more than anything else is an unwillingness to feel the discomfort that comes with needs that aren't being satisfied. The NVC process for dealing with this discomfort is to mourn the loss of satisfaction. This means to put your attention on the sadness and loss, to feel it, and thereby to discharge the emotional energy that is tied up with these feelings. So remember, a long time ago we talked about how needs use sensations to communicate to us, and that those sensations organize themselves into what we call emotional energy. That emotional energy sometimes needs to be discharged in order to free the person to have the energy to go into motion and make change in their life. And so mourning is one of the ways to discharge feelings. And I've read somewhere that most emotions, when allowed to discharge, can discharge in 20 seconds or so. They can last a lifetime if you avoid that. And unfortunately, in our culture, we have a tendency to avoid experiencing mourning, the sadder feelings. And that gets in the way of being able to discover what it is that you're really needing. This getting comfortable with uncomfortable feelings is one of the hardest parts of this process because of the way our culture feels about those feelings. Not doing this is also a major cause of violence in relationships and in our world. So a lot of what people are doing in terms of violence, either NVC kind of violence where it's just communicating your needs as judgments of others, moral judgments that other people are wrong or bad, or as is done in a lot of parts of the world, people acting on those judgments by actually doing violence, physical violence or war, is really largely the result of people being unwilling to mourn the dissatisfied feelings. Because once you've done that, there's no more energy that you need to discharge by attacking other people or trying to get it off of you and project it onto other people. And so a lot of the hatred and violence that's in the world is just an attempt to avoid feelings. And so it's a very big part of this practice to get comfortable with your uncomfortable feelings, which I know is a funny sentence, but it's unfortunately an important truth about this process. My guess is that forbidden needs are at work here again. When we were young, mourning the dissatisfaction only to have the need rejected again and again probably cut into our trust that discharging does any good at all. And then there are often people right there in front of you to project those feelings on, which does provide immediate, if temporary, relief. So judgment is often a symptomatic temporary fix for trying to get rid of the discomfort that an unsatisfied need communicates to you. But judging other people doesn't cause the need to get satisfied, and so the dissatisfaction is going to continue. And in the same way that when our psyche has something to communicate to us, like in a dream, if it really wants us to get the message, if we reject the information of that message, what the psyche does is it turns up the volume. So the first time you have a dream about something that your psyche wants you to know about, it's very coded and it just seems like it's a bunch of crazy images. If you don't take the message, if you don't do dream interpretation, and you start to have kind of scarier and louder dreams. And if it's really a message that the psyche wants you to have, insists that you have, what it will do is it'll make the dream so scary it'll wake you up. We call those nightmares. But the truth is what's going on there is the psyche is just really is trying to shake you, and it shakes you awake. And the same is true about needs that are not getting satisfied. You know, I mean, take your need for hunger. If you don't eat after you get that message, you get hungrier and hungrier until you start saying, I'm starving, and then you actually do start starving. So this is the way that the unconscious does its communication as the message gets more and more urgent. So validating the person's loss can be an important form of empathy, especially if they don't know that that's what they need. So I'm just going to tell a quick story. You know, I did an NVC in the prisons, and we had a prisoner who, I was working in the women's prison, and this really big, powerful woman who finally, after years and years of being in prison, had put together with the staff a beautiful plan. She had a job, she had a place to go to, about to be released in a few days, and some piece of paper showed up that she was going to have to go back to court, be in prison for another 6 weeks, and lose all of those opportunities. And she came into class, and she was clearly just fuming underneath, but was unable to experience that because it was just so upsetting to her. And so when the people in the class tried to do empathy with her, and they said, you know, I'm wondering if you're feeling upset about this, she kept saying, no, I'm fine. I'm fine. I knew this was going to happen. It always happens. Always. We recognize that as a forbidden need, right? Forbidden needs feel like it's always going to go like this. So I was watching the class try to do empathy with her and not accept the level where she was at, where she was trying to protect herself from the intensity of the mourning that was going on. And so I said to her, so I'm amazed that you're handling this so well. I get that as disappointing as this is, you're kind of a trooper about this stuff. You know how the prison system works, and you want us to know that you're handling this. And I get that. And she went, finally, yeah, that's true. And I said, I really get that. And what I'm noticing is that I'm not handling it as well as you are, and I'm wondering if you are willing to hear how this is landing on me. And she said, okay. And I said, I'm just devastated for you. I feel so terrible. You've worked so hard to get this plan together and did such a great job setting everything up, given how it is in prison to have gotten all that together. And then this one piece of paper comes along and just pulls the rug out from under your feet, and I am just devastated. And she began to weep. She got to do her mourning. And what I did with empathy was to accept without judgment the level that she was at and share with her a different level of truth, in this case, projecting it onto myself instead of onto her. And that gave her the freedom to do the mourning that she needed to do. So it's our 30 minutes together. So my plan is we're going to have a special guest star coming online with me. You're not going to want to miss that. Be able to order this book, Loving Conflict by Max Rivers. I'm delighted about this book. This is everything that I want to say to you is in this book. And so if you're enjoying hearing what it is that I've been saying to you, reading little excerpts from the book and talking about what they mean to me and what how I'd like for them to help you, I invite you to go out and get the book from Amazon. I'd enjoy it if you folks would buy 5 or 10 copies of this book, and they make great gifts. I can't tell you how many people say to me, if only I had this information 10 years ago. So find people who are 10 years younger than you and give them copies of this book. So we're talking about empathy, and your homework tonight is to notice how you listen to people, and notice if you watch two people talking, notice how they're listening to each other. It's very interesting. This is an incredible, important skill. And the way that people listen to each other has a lot to do with how well they're communicating and how well they get along. And you now have some skills for learning how to listen. So if you're in a challenging conversation with your partner, I had one just this afternoon with my wife. I just got back from Bali, and we're trying to figure out the import of that we now have world travel as something that we're going to start adding into our life, which is going to add a lot more pleasure and a lot more complications. And so having conversations about the topic, that in this case we were talking about world travel, brought up in both of us so what does this mean in terms of how important am I to you? Really wasn't what the conversation seemed to be about, but the need underneath was about the need for connection, for feeling like we mattered and we cared about each other. And so because we're both NVC trainers and we do this teamwork stuff together, the conversation switched from strategies down to needs, and we had a beautiful, loving, connective conversation. And I want that for you. So try those on in the next 24 hours. And we're entering into the second half of the book. We're done with how do you fix your broken relationship. And let's talk about how to use NVC in your fixed relationship in order to create more love and connection and have these beautiful two-resourced people, two-cup kinds of conversations where you're pouring love into each other simultaneously. So that will start tomorrow. So have an empathetic 24 hours, and we're going to start with the return of effortless love tomorrow. This is Max Rivers, the Marriage Mediator, signing off. You can go to maxrivers.net to find out more about what I do, or themarriagemediator.net to make appointments to do work with me or to watch videos of clients talking about what that was like. And I'll see you tomorrow at 6. Good night. The marathon continues. Today's the 16th day. I'm reading from my book, Loving Conflict, by Max Rivers, about how to use embodied NVC and the teamwork method in order to help your relationship and bring your relationship into an even deeper level. So tomorrow is going to be the special guest star. You're not going to want to miss tomorrow. And we'll also be starting the second half of the book. The first half of the book is called Tired of Having the Same Old Argument. It was originally going to be the name of the book. But as I continue to do my work and do my writing, I realize that's actually only half of the issue, solving the problem that people have in their relationships. The other half is once you've figured out how to use conflict in order to create more connection and intimacy, how do you create even more connection and intimacy using those same skills to communicate each other? And so the second half of the book is called The Return of Effortless Love. So you started with the infatuation period, went into conflict, which we then switch into the difference and the learning stage. And tomorrow we'll be getting into the mature relationship, how to use these same skills to make your love go even deeper. So we're going to be starting in Chapter 5, Still Empathy, Preparing to Listen. So I want to teach you the skills of empathy so that you can use them because they're eminently practical. They really work in relationship. They also work in parenting. They also work in any kind of leadership or work environment. This is really something everybody should know how to do. The fact that we don't know how to listen is the source of most of the violence in our culture. So let's dive in and learn how to listen. When I go into a state of empathic listening, I take a breath and drop down into my body to access my base state. This is like what I do when buying bulk oil at the food co-op. First, I weigh the container and any leftover oil in it. That way I know how much new oil I'm buying. That starting weight is called the tare. My deep breath gives me a tare measurement of my own sensation, emotional state. I try to calm myself down to a completely receptive state. Then I listen and perceive. So when I cross the threshold to go into a mediation, and I've done this since even when I was in small claims court, I wanted to bring with me this sense of non-judgment and peace. And you can do the same thing going into a situation, maybe with your spouse or with someone else, where you know there's some tension or upset. Take some deep breaths and connect with yourself. I can tell you that almost every time people complain about not being able to connect with their partners, if I ask them the question, so are you connected with yourself right now? When they look inside, they realize they're not. So the first step in connecting with others is deeply connecting with yourself. And in our model, that means connecting first with what you're feeling, meaning what's the sensations that are going on in your body, and what it is that you're needing. And if you're going to be a professional, a mediator, or a parent, or a teacher, you might want to park those needs, meaning put them in a place where you can come back to them when you're with someone who's in a resourced state to help you connect with them, and that person might be yourself. Empathy is not just listening, because I'm not just using my ears or my mind for comprehending the words. I'm listening with my body and my eyes, especially if the person is talking story or judgment. I have noticed over time that my ear is tuned to things that sound untrue. They stand out like red flags to me. I don't mean objectively untrue. I mean things that don't sound like the person is saying what is true for them. Remember in earlier readings that we did from the needs chapter, we said that universal human needs, another name for them, is the truth, what's true about this person, their personal truth in this moment. And so that's really what we're looking to help them identify, what is true for them. And there are a lot of things that get in the way of that in this culture. There are a lot of people who, especially people in relationship, don't believe that they can speak their truth to their partner because they think that they'll be judged or they won't be lovable or whatever. But you can't have true love if you're not being your true self. And so if the person that you're with can't handle your truth, and I'm talking about speaking just about yourself, not about strategies, not about what they're doing wrong, not even about what the two of you are going to do or even what you're going to do, but just connecting with what is true for you. I have a desire for connection. I'm hungry. I have a feeling of sadness right now, and I'm mourning some loss, and I'm not sure what it is. Whatever your truth is, that's the next step. First step is connecting with yourself. The second step is being willing to communicate what it is that you're connecting with, what is Marshall used to call what's alive in you, with the people you relate with, and in particular, with the person that you love. So there's what we call a deep empathy process in NVC that I don't think Marshall particularly talked about, but I think a lot of people do talk about these days. In the deep empathy process, if it seems there is still more below the satisfaction of the need that they know about, you can ask, so if you had your surface need met, what else might you need? I've seen a person go 5 or 6 levels down before they got to the foundational need, often a forbidden need, just by your keeping asking, and if you had that, what else might you need? The way you know that you are at the bottom is when you sense that feeling inside yourself, the asker, the empathizer, that the room has changed. It will feel like a release of tension in your body. I have a belief that when we're in the presence of someone who's unresourced, remember our definition of that is it's a person who either doesn't even know they have an unsatisfied need, or they realize they've got an unsatisfied need, but they don't know what it is. And so they're in an unresourced state. They don't know the need that they need to get met. That people around them on an unconscious level feel some tension and anxiety being in connection with a person who's in that state. And so one of the delights of doing empathy well is that when you help the other person get into a resourced state, identify that in fact they have an unsatisfied need, and get in touch with the energy of it, maybe not the name of it, and maybe not what they're going to do about it, but when they get in touch with what's alive in them, the energy of the need, they relax. And my experience is, being the mediator, we're doing empathy with them, that I can feel that relaxation happen in my body too. And in mediation school, although they didn't know about needs, they used to say, there's a point in a mediation where it just seems like the room changes, the light gets softer, and everybody's voice seems to soften. And that soft state is what we call the resourced state. What we are not listening for. Number one, strategies. I don't listen for the content of a strategy. It's probably wrong. Otherwise, it would have met the need. Most of the time, the strategies put forth by an unresourced person are so wrong-headed, they function only as fuel for the story. But they do tell us about some need that the speaker wants met. So they might say, why can't my boss just step in and keep this person from interrupting my meetings all the time? This gives us a sense that ease and cooperation and teamwork and support are some of this person's issues. We're not listening for number two, judgments. When you turn judgments around to get to the need, you have to be careful not to blurt out the need. The function of empathy is to help the speaker identify their own needs, if at all possible. Not for the listener to tell the speaker what they are needing. Sometimes people are so disconnected from their own needs that it can help to do a need guess, which sounds like, so I'm wondering if maybe what you're needing is this. Does that work for you? Does that seem right? So the difference between saying to someone, so you need comfort, and making an empathy guess, a needs-based guess, I'm wondering if what you're needing is connection and comfort, is it creates, in the way that you're communicating it, a softness and an opening. First of all, what you're doing is you're helping them look inside to see if that's true, which is useful. And second of all, it leaves room for them to say, because you asked them a question, no, it's not quite that. It's more like I just really want to get things done. I think it's more like efficiency. The third thing we're not looking for is something that sounds really untrue. Hopelessness and despair indicate a forbidden or hidden need. So if they are touching into a forbidden or hidden need, they are likely first to experience the despair of not getting this need met. I'm listening for words like can't, never, and always, because despair is sadness plus forever. And it's often expressed in these words like, well, I just can't, or they never, or I always. If I hear this kind of talk, I am likely to do the, what they used to call in mediation school, the dumb mediator. And I repeat what they said back to them as if I completely believe that it's true. I may even push it from I probably won't to so you say you would never. The goal of this approach is to let them hear how untrue what they've said is, and they will often say, oh, no, it's not like I never. In reevaluation co-counseling, they used to call this crowding the pattern. There's only room for one person in an untrue story. And so if you join them, you actually push them out of the story. and then they're left looking back at themselves, and they may come up with the truth. Don't get caught up in the story. The first rule of empathy listening is don't get caught up in the story. This sounds really simple, but it's incredibly hard for most people to do. But don't do it. As soon as you repeat any aspect of the situational data, you lose your standing as a current time healer and become a part of the problem and upset. So people often do this as friends. You know, somebody tells a story and you get, oh my God, they did that? That's terrible. And you join them in the upset of their story. And that can be fun. It's not particularly healing usually, but it does create what Carolyn Mace calls a relationship of woundology. So you're sharing the wound with them, and that feels good. It's sympathy, but it doesn't tend to be particularly healing. And the relationships that form from that don't tend to last, because if one person actually does heal, the basis of the relationship gets broken. The situation in their story activated one or more of your partner's needs and left those needs unsatisfied. The situation also gave your partner a sense that they weren't going to get those needs met, possibly a hidden or forbidden need. Your partner can't identify their needs and feelings, so instead they're now describing their thoughts and judgments that they have about the situation and the people involved. If you join in on the content of the story, you'll be joining in on the upset and reinforcing the reality of the judgments. According to NVC, there's no information about the person being judged in a judgment. If I call you a slob, it's not true that you're a slob. You're fine. Obviously, you're happy being just as neat as you're being. It may not be working for me, and so what may be true is as clean as you like it doesn't actually work for my need for cleanliness, but that doesn't make you a slob. It just makes you need less cleanliness than I do. But as an empathy giver, if you join in on the judgments and validate them, you're going to lock them down and convince them that actually the problem is their partner. And that's going to keep them away from identifying what it is that they need and getting their need met. Reflecting their story back to them just pulls their attention out into the situation, back into the past. Almost all stories and judgments are about the past. Some of them are about the future. Very few of them are about the present. And the present moment is the only one you can actually get your needs met in. Instead of going down inside of themselves and into the present moment, the only moment when their needs can be met. What we are listening for. When we listen empathically, we are listening for the needs underneath the feelings. We define empathy as listening for the needs-based feelings. Just as there are different kinds of listening, there are many different kinds of feelings. Most of the feelings that upset people are the result of the story they are telling themselves. These thought feelings are not the result of their needs, and so they are not what we're listening for. This is a big change that I brought in from what Marshall was suggesting. I think Marshall was so embodied that he just automatically skipped over the thought feelings and was listening for the feelings or the sensation feelings. But he didn't write about that. And a lot of the rest of us who aren't as empathic as he is ended up often following down the thought feelings, the feelings that were the result of the things they were thinking rather than actually their needs or the judgments they had or the beliefs that they had that were contradicted by the situation. Now, you can actually do some discharge, help them discharge some of the energy that they have created with their own thinking. But in my experience, it's better to just shortcut through all that and just skip all of the judgments and thought feelings and look for the needs and the feelings that are the result of their needs. One way to identify a thought feeling is that when the word feel is followed by the word like or that, as in the sentence, I feel that you are a jerk. There's no such feeling as you are a jerk. So whenever people say, I feel that, or I feel like, what's coming next is not a feeling. Don't follow that one down. It's the same thing as when the word need is followed by you. Needs don't refer to other people. So when somebody says, I need you to clean up your room, that's not a need. They may want you to. That's a strategy. But it's not a need. Needs only don't refer to other people. Feelings are not thoughts. I found that if I repeat these kinds of thought-based feelings back, so you're feeling the other person is wrong, all I do is reinforce the thoughts that are making them upset. Instead of getting them out of their story about the past and into the healing present, I've re-stimulated the past. So this is an important way, little tool for not following stories and repeating stories back to people if you're trying to heal them with empathy. Because if they talk about a feeling that or a feeling like, and you repeat it back to them, you've now validated that that is a feeling, and that's the feeling that they need to be dealing with, and it's not. Instead, I focus my attention on the feelings they're showing, because those are present time, and that's where I want them, in the present where their needs can get satisfied. So if they say they are happy for their divorcing partner, but they are not showing happiness on their face or their body language, I might say, I'm wondering if a part of you is also feeling sad that they're leaving. So it's kind of fascinating when you really start paying attention to the disparity between the people's affect, their body language, their tone of voice, what they're showing on their face, and what they're saying. You know, I'm really happy about what's going on, kind of thing. You're like, really? That's what happiness looks like? I don't think so. I mean, you won't say that to them, but that should be a red flag to you that that isn't the feeling, or it's not the certainly not the only feeling. There may actually be a part of them that's happy that they're getting divorced or whatever, but clearly that's not everything. And one of the things that Marshall said, which doesn't get reinforced very much, but I think is incredibly important, is there were basically two kinds of things to do about needs. When they get satisfied, we want to celebrate the satisfaction. And when they're dissatisfied, you want to mourn the loss. Because oftentimes a situation meets some of the qualities of a need or of the needs that are present and leaves some needs or some part of needs unsatisfied. And what people have a tendency to do is to pick one, either it's the celebration or the other, the mourning. And people tend to do that habitually. So men often celebrate and women often mourn. But sometimes you have somebody who's got kind of a depressed personality and they'll do the mourning part and not the celebrating. Or somebody who's self-aggrandizing, they'll do the celebrating and not the mourning. What Marshall said is doing one without the other, if both are actually true, will confuse the people around you and won't bring about the full satisfaction and healing. And so this is like kind of a new idea that in the same moment, you may be celebrating what's working and mourning what isn't and feeling all of those feelings and sharing all of those feelings. In the teamwork method, when we get to how you talk to your partner, which we do more in the second half of the book, we call that the complex sentence because we have complex feelings. So you can say, you know, when you did that, it really met this need of mine, didn't meet this need of mine, and it awakened this other need of mine. And all three of those things are true, and people have a tendency to pick one thing and communicate that. But in a mature relationship, since you want true love, you want to tell the whole truth so that your partner is fully informed to be able to make informed decisions about how to negotiate with you so that both of you can get all of your needs met. If I can't read their body language, I'll try to notice what I am feeling while listening to them. This is a surprisingly accurate way to learn what a person is feeling beneath their judgments. So sometimes when people are being very judgmental and their affect is not at all what they're saying, the way they're looking is really just not a match and it's just really confusing. Or some people just have such a different way of relating to themselves and to their feelings that I can't follow what it is that's going on with them. What I have found is, as they're coming to the end of what they're saying, and I'm supposed to say something back, and I realize I have no idea what just transpired, what I'll do is I'll look inside my own body, and I'll notice what I'm feeling. It's often confusion at the top, but then on a deeper level, I'll notice that something else is going on for me, and I'll say that, the feeling guess of what they may be feeling. And like 98% of the time, they go, oh, yeah, that is what I'm feeling. I think it's really interesting. I think that on a unconscious level, we do communicate to each other through our more through our bodies than we're aware of. The other thing that I sometimes do is if I really can't tell what's going on with a person, I'll try matching my body language to their body language, like however it is, whatever it is that they're doing, kind of subtly and just sort of slowly move myself. And then feel what it feels like for me to be in that body position. And then I'll try that as a guess. I'm wondering if it feels like this person's a pain in the neck. The unconscious has a great sense of humor. And they'll often say, yeah, they really are annoying to me. They're really frustrating. So empathy is not just listening to the words. Many times, it's really not listening to the words. So we'll end today with making a feeling guess, which I've just kind of demonstrated. There's a funny thing about people, myself included, we don't like to be told what it is we're feeling. You've probably heard this dialogue somewhere along the line. What are you so angry about? I'm not angry. Then why are you shouting? I'm not shouting. You want to hear shouting? I'll give you shouting. You ever heard that one? This phenomenon is so universal. I suggest that you don't ever tell people what you think they're feeling. Instead, share your perception as a feeling guess. A feeling guess checks out what the other person is feeling as a question that allows lots of room for them to correct our assumption. They sound like, so I'm wondering if you're feeling, or was that sad for you? So they can always say no. And then the value of this is, it puts their attention looking in to see what it is that they're feeling. It works better than saying to somebody, what are you feeling? Because a lot of people don't know what to do with that question. But if you make a feeling guess, just like a computer programmer or a lawyer who like can't answer the question, what are you feeling? If you say, I'm wondering if you're feeling jealous. They will look down and they'll come back and say, no, it's not really jealousy. You know, it's more like envy. I actually had that happen. I had to look it up in a dictionary and he was right. That was what he was feeling. So feeling guesses are a way to avoid conflict in helping people identify what it is that they're feeling. Don't ask people what they're feeling. Make a feeling guess. For people who are clearly allergic to feeling words applied to them, I'll sometimes use myself as a projection screen for what they might be feeling, as in, I'd be angry if that happened to me. Is that how it landed on you? So basically, I'm putting the feeling on me and then asking them the feeling guess question. So it's kind of one step removed to make it even more comfortable for people who are really not comfortable for feelings. Or I might choose a feeling word that isn't so touchy-feely. So instead of saying sad, I might say upsetting or confused or unsatisfied, which people who don't like to have soft feelings associated with them might be more willing to accept a synonym, which is less touchy-feely. The last piece I'm going to read is guessing works even if you're wrong. This is really a powerful piece of information. Interestingly, feeling guesses are helpful even when you guess wrong. In fact, it's almost better to guess wrong because the goal of this process is not to tell them what is true about them, but to help them figure out what is going on inside of themselves. When you make a feeling guess, even people who couldn't name what they are feeling for $1 million will look inside and try your suggestion on. If it's right, they now know what it is that they're feeling in the present. If you guess wrong, they can now feel the difference between your guess and what they're actually feeling, and they'll often be able to say so. So with this simple feeling guess process, you've accomplished 4 important goals. 1, you got their attention off their story and the past. 2, you got them focusing in the present moment. 3, you got their attention focused on their bodies, where their needs reside. And 4, you helped them identify what it is that they're feeling. And you did all of that without even guessing correctly. So that's our half hour together today. So the homework for tonight is going to be, when you're in conversations with people and you're noticing that they're having a feeling, try doing a feeling guess and see what happens instead of telling them what it is they're feeling. See if it works. I found this to be incredibly easy because you don't even have to be right. But it's amazingly effective, especially with people who are not good at identifying their feelings. So that's tonight's reading of Loving Conflict by Max Rivers, available on Amazon in paperback form and in Kindle form, Loving Conflict. So tomorrow, we're going to have our special surprise guest speaker, and so you don't want to miss that. So have a empathetic 24 hours, have fun guessing, and try guessing wrong sometimes and see if that works too. Okay, friends, I'll see you tomorrow. Peace.